on the program, Eric Smith is the first author and one of his colleagues, Harold.
Hyder, yes.
Harold, sorry. Will be doing a presentation this afternoon.
All right. So, hello, everybody. No relationships to this clause. I was told to really, really make sure that I said that. I'm going to tell you a little bit about a project that we did in conjunction with a different program from San Mateo County. So the goal of San Mateo County is to have been traditionally to help people with behavioral health issues, mainly stabilize from their crises and then control their symptoms. In the last few years, there's been a shift in trying to incorporate more recovery-oriented principles so that people actually live happy, nice lives outside of the system. Things like smoking and anything related to tobacco have been not really taken into consideration because people were focusing on the big immediate crises happening and because the serious addictions were more immediate. My job in behavioral health is partly defined as having the lived experience. So I'm one of the people that this gentleman was talking about in the bathroom, you know, that was in some bar, you know, a crazy bar shooting cocaine, you know, that I had that experience. So thank you for doing that work. What happened is that I was doing this work and all this time I went to rehab and I was in rehab for a whole year. And during this time that I was in rehab, people actually would give me cigarettes and tobacco. You know, are you having a hard day? You know, here's some tobacco. And they also give me a lot of sugar. You know, it was like daily servings of generous, you know, cake and colors and artificial flavors and things like that. So through my work here, I started learning all these things about tobacco. Now, some of you are familiar with some of the information, like half the cigarettes smoked in the United States are smoked with people with mental illnesses, and of course about half the people that die every year, 200,000, are people with mental health illnesses. People with mental health illnesses die an average 25 years younger because a lot of it traced to tobacco and smoking. Yet, nothing was really done, not a lot was being done. So we got together with Derek Smith, who's my co-creator here, and he's over there in the corner. And we said, well, you know, why don't we start talking about this? So we said, well, you know, this is our opinion, but why don't we go around and ask people? So we did several focus groups with different group of consumers of alcohol and other drugs and also mental health. We went to peer group centers and treatment facilities and things like that, and we found out that yes, people now have a lot of more insight than we thought about smoking, and they do want to quit. And we also talked to our clinicians and other staff, and we found, among other things, that they are not confident about assessing and treatment. And not only that, but they didn't think that our clients wanted to quit. They didn't think that's we did some surveys, and that's what we found out. So we did several discussions. We met with people, started talking with everybody, so we did these presentations. We'd do things like go to the staff meetings and ask, you know, to be given 15 minutes and talk about that, or go to the different AOD providers meeting and sneak in there, and just go to every place that we could get in. We went to NAMI, found actually a great presenter that went and presented with them and created a debate where people, some of our clients said, I don't want to quit and this is why. So it's really, really lovely, interesting conversations. And also with boarding care operators. Some of you may know the boarding care is these houses where people, our clients go and live there and they receive some sort of support. And they're really, really supportive. Everybody was really supportive and really open and really willing to learn. And they had much more insight than we thought. So we did all that, and we engaged a program that we have in San Mateo County called Total Wellness. So they have an advisory board. We went there. We talked to the change agents in these different groups, the training and workforce development, the lived experience, just anywhere that we could get in. And then we did the surveys, and what the survey showed us was that the clinicians really were not confident. They really didn't know how to go about tobacco, and they were very afraid to do it. So we found actually several people that would come and develop trainings for us. And we found this peer-to-peer model that we thought would be the best to work with our clients. We also engaged Jordi Prochaska, which is a nationally recognized leader in the subject. And we developed, among other things, a quit kit for clinicians. So it's a paper that our clinicians would use to learn about tobacco and to help people quit. So this is the part where we wrote inching about in the title, because this is the part that has been actually the hardest to move forward. You know, we kept thinking, you know, let's it'd be very, very easy to change a few points on the contracts that we have with our provider agencies and get them to make big changes, get them to change the whole campus and the whole programs. But that has been actually really difficult. I have been requesting a meeting with the possibility to address the leadership meetings for about a year, and I've been getting to run around, you know, and I think that little by little they're becoming more and more open. But it's been a bit of an uphill battle to get to talk to them. But regardless, we developed a plan for smoke-free campuses, and we develop a paper that is going to be used, hopefully, by leadership to bring about this policy. We have been looking at policies written in other counties and see how we can present it in a way that is the least possible pain and the easiest way for them to accept it. So let's see. So we had found that there had been, since the last like 10 years, sporadically a leader would come up and say, you know, we need to do something about this. And we found a nurse that actually had been running a group very quietly in a clinic for years. And we thought, you know, this guy's doing such great work. Let's see if we can duplicate it. And we did. So we found some people to get trained in this model from Breathe California. It's called the Ash Kickers. And we trained these people to facilitate the groups. And they have been doing that. And now we managed to have one of these groups in each of the five clinics that the county has. It took us about 3 years to get that going. And also, I mentioned before Chad Morris. So he came and we actually managed to train 50 peers. I don't think many of them are working on the curriculum right now, but that's happening. The process has started for them to start facilitating throughout the county. It has been very slow, but it's happening. Something else that we did is we kind of like dial up the use of the helpline. I got a chance to run several groups, and every week I come in and ask people, you know, call the line is great. And every class, people would come back, and nobody had called. So one day we just brought a phone in the room, and we all called, and people's eyes were like going like, wow, this is really great. And ever since then, there's been much more participation using the quit line. Something else that we managed to do is we have a publication called Wellness Matters. And every chance that we get, we sneak in an article. And over the years, in the last 3 years, we've had probably about 7 or 8 articles. And we also managed to send really pretty little things that say ask, advise, refer. And every so often somebody calls me from that and say, well, tell me more about this. So even though this is like an 8-page document that comes monthly and not everybody reads it, still there's been some successes coming from that. Something great that has happened is that through this whole process, we've managed to engage some of the consumer leaders. And we have been helping develop and get into more and more responsibility and leadership positions within the county. So, and some of them have actually quit. So, and these are very, very visible leaders, and they have been total advocates about it. So, we helped them as best as we could, and we stuck with them. One of them, it took her about 2 years and about 8 tries, and she finally made it. And we are planning on doing some videos with her and with some of the other leaders. Because it's really interesting how they can really talk to the, I don't know if I'm doing that here. They're very prominent in the consumer community, and they have a lot of say. So something else that happened is that we got a big grant for the Total Wellness Program, and because we have been doing so much talking about smoking, actually they were very receptive to us, and they've been from the beginning wanting to include tobacco and smoking cessation into their program. Okay, I think that was that's about that. Thank you so much.
You seem dismissive about the idea that maybe pre-service, you know, in the police academy wouldn't necessarily be effective in terms of trying to, you know, educate police officers about this, and I'm wondering whether or not, in light of the fact that that would ideally reach all the officers, whether or not you wouldn't start with the police academies as the first line of intervention.
Yeah, no, I apologize if I seem dismissive. No, I think that that's a great idea. I think maybe what I meant to is like dismissive of the, it's more difficult to get in there. It's more difficult to change that curriculum. But I actually know of at least one circumstance in which harm reduction advocates have actually become part of the curriculum, and that's in Delaware, which a few years ago changed state law to legalize syringe exchange. And were actually able to work, and it took a couple of years to change the police department. I think it's the, you know, I actually don't know if that is the police academy for the Wilmington Police Department as opposed to the state academy curriculum, but at least for the academy that the Wilmington officers go to, it actually now has a module explaining, you know, kind of like, you know, explain kind of what we talked about here, the public health basis for the law, what the law is, and how that should affect practice. So it can happen. I'm not dismissive of the idea at all, just it's, you know, this is kind of a backdoor way to do this training, and it's a lot easier to do that than to change the curriculum. But I'm certainly not opposed to that. Yeah.
I have a question about yours as well. Was that like the state police?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, the beauty of it is, one of the slides that I briefed at the end was the limitations, right? And one of the limitations is that these are almost exclusively officers who have decided that they want to get the CIT training. They want to be crisis intervention team officers. One of the beauties of that is that they are from departments all over the state. They're from, in North Carolina, sheriffs actually have a large law enforcement function. Some states are basically run the prisons, but in North Carolina, outside of cities, sheriffs are your sort of first police responder. So there's some sheriff's agencies, police departments, nobody from the state highway patrol. But it's assuming like 49 different agencies have sent officers from 49 different agencies, you actually go to this training, right? So there's been 12 different training locations, but nearly 50 different departments and from all over the state, urban, rural, whatever. Did I mention that? Is that what you're asking?
And also, with the cost,
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I mean, one of the interesting things, right, is that this wasn't designed as an academic project, right? So it wasn't, you know, I mean, certainly the information, we've seen it, and it's good, but, yes, we can definitely share it. I think it might be actually more useful. You know, now we're thinking, well, maybe we should actually sit down and think about, okay, we have 15 minutes, exactly what should an optimal training look like? You know, because it wasn't designed as that, you know, it was just the NGO, sharing what they knew. But yeah, we can definitely get you what they're using. But the asterisks that we're actually working on, like, well, what they should be doing, that would, you know.
To that end, I know you guys didn't develop the training, but are you thinking about, or are they thinking about doing some kind of train-the-trainer model, so that since you do have folks coming from all over the place, they can go back to their organizations or to their agencies and train the other staff?
Yeah, we've actually talked about that as being a strategy to get this information out there, so it's something we've talked about. The reason it's been so effective is I think we've got ex or retired law enforcement doing the training, and so we would have to find someone who would be able to reach the entire state and every department with that.
Well, but I mean, the people that attend your training going back to their agencies, so it would be a
larger impact. We have definitely talked about that. We haven't talked about how we are going to roll that out yet, but
yeah, and we're also thinking about, you know, this is all sort of accidental, right? So there's no dedicated funding for this. So we know we're now looking at possible funding sources to do a number of things, including exactly what you're talking about.
And one of the things we were able to do with this is have a conference at the state legislature with different law enforcement officers and our representatives to talk about this, because no elected official wants to be against, you know, keeping law enforcement safe. And so we've actually made so much progress on this issue, which has been so otherwise divisive in North Carolina. So it's had an impact not just on law enforcement, but also on elected officials as well.
Do you include hepatitis B in that a lot? Because it seems, I'm from Colorado, and we talk a lot more about hep C than HIV transmission, because in general, to my understanding, it's a lot more prevalent for needle-stick injury.
Yeah, that's right. And the nice thing about them is that they're spread in, for the purposes of this training, in the same way, right? So you can, you know, we do talk about both, and we do in the training talk about how you're actually much more likely to get hepatitis. But the thing is, like I said, people are really worried about HIV, so that's really kind of the hook to get them interested. You know, we have a way to reduce your risk of getting something you're concerned about. But you're absolutely right; the chances of getting hepatitis C are much greater.
I have a question for the next presenter. I just wanted to know, what are your plans to take the success stories to? What are you going to do with the success stories?
Yes, we we're also developing a thing called Photo Boys, where we give photographic cameras to people, and they go around, take photographs of that. And we're developing a thing called a digital storytelling,
so that
these clients that have quit will be displayed there, and we can show around as an example of good success stories.
Do you have a website, or how do people know about
it? Well, internally within Santa Fe County, you have ways to disseminate information.
Okay, that's
yeah. Yes, but and we actually do have a website. I don't know it by memory, but I can write it down for you. I can find it and give it to you. Where some of the previous digital stories and Photo Voice projects are
on the website. Yeah, I've seen some more of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Focusing also thinking about with recovery programs. Sometimes, I mean, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, they'll encourage you to kind of like use another substance rather than the one like tobacco to kind of taper off. Or, I mean, I know in my own personal life, I have people that I'm really close to, and they've taken up smoking or a lot with the teeth and things like that.
Well, there's a lot. What we found is there's a lot of misconceptions about that. So in the ALD component of behavioral health, we found a lot of resistance because first because a lot of the counselors smoke, and it's like part of the culture. You go to an AA meeting and people are outside smoking, like, you know, it's like the usual thing. You go and you relate to people who smoke, you give me a cigarette. And in the mental health, there's the idea that smoking actually helps you with your symptoms, which is not true. So that's what we found, is there's a lot of a need for education, for information. And in the plan that we develop, we're addressing those things. And hopefully, I think by next year, we'll have more concrete trainings to offer to our staff.
I know that CDC put out the same kind of OHD as there was the number tier one.
Right.
So in your interviews with your key informants in the Southeast region, what are the challenges with the faith community, because they're mostly dealing with abstinence only as their major. So are they having, and this is supposed to be across whether they get information for contraceptives as well. So have they talked about any challenges with the faith community?
Yeah, they have. And so it's really trying to understand where the community at currently when they began the program and what was going to take to change the community perception of evidence-based programs. And against abstinence only, that had been such a strong federal initiative for such a long period of time. So it really is a culture shift in that respect. CDC started that effort even 5 years previous, in the previous grant, trying to understand what it was going to take communities to adopt evidence-based instead of abstinence only into marriage. And part of that is reaching out to the faith community and enlisting them in the discussion about what it would take for them to be more supportive of programs for youth that are more evidence-based and less focused. Oftentimes, it does begin with the recognition that for our youngest youth, abstinence only is an important message. So it's not as though abstinence isn't appropriate, but that as youth age and become sexually active, they will need comprehensive information and access to contraceptives. Of course, the other piece of that is whether or not other segments of the community, including the parents and other people invested in the well-being of youth, will engage in the discussion and try to shape the decisions that are being made in the communities. But yeah, all of them recognize that the faith communities are a critical component within the communities, and there's outreach to investing them in one of the groups. Either the core partner leadership team or the community action team, because of the strong voice that they give up in the communities.
Okay. Other comments or questions?
Thousand years ago when I was actually working. I found, especially in doing some research with the counselors, is that it's almost as they encourage if you get them off of one substance, if they're having some mental health issues, is that like smoking is encouraged, it's better that they smoke. At least they're off of cocaine, at least they're off of marijuana, how do you change the mindset of the providers, the counselors, that, that is you exchanging one devil for another?
I had to show them a lung with cancer. I gave them a picture with lung cancer, brain cancer. Show them the bad pictures. That would tell them.
Yeah. Well, that is definitely
bad.
We managed to print some big big poster.
Yeah.
And the scariest one was a picture of somebody,
See where people come in and show where people have to talk.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right. So we've done that. We've actually showed those posters.
You have to let some people know what it's like, how people are living with cancer, what it's done to them. And that changes the perception of people. That's what it takes for some people.
I agree.
Have a panel discussion. Bring people in. Bring doctors in. Bring nurses in. Bring social workers in. Have a town hall meeting. Put it out there. Put the faces out there. Let the families come in. Let them tell the story. That makes a difference.
Yeah. You know, I agree. We have been putting some posters in the clinics and in the centers.
Let me finish.
So the poster that has actually gotten the most calls and the most response from people is a poster that shows half the person, half of a healthy human being, and the other half is affected with all the other organs and the skin and things like that. But for your question about the providers, well, it turned out that actually if people quit all drugs, including tobacco, at the same time, the rate of quit is much higher. It's like 25% higher. So it's higher than any pill or than any treatment or any intervention is if people quit at the same time. So when we were talking with the AOD providers, their jaws were on the floor. They couldn't believe it. But it turned out that is something that is totally true. So if we bring, I think, what we have been doing is bringing that information and that awareness, and also, and it was really hard to see in the catalog, the ATLD, you were talking about ATLD, we have been saying, we put the T back on ATLD, you know.
They got a suit, I think, says it. In fact, they can't, I mean, they're saying, the tobacco industry, they take the T out, so now we have to say alcohol, because they don't want tobacco.
I'm not aware of that, and I don't think we're going that way.
I know, because I have a contract with the state, but on their drink, and they were saying something about some state, they don't say ATOD. We still say ATOD, but they don't say ATOD anymore.
Okay, well, we don't say ATOD. We're in the process of saying it. We say AOD. So in that process of bringing the tea, has been really useful to bring that information that I was talking about, and to also to call things the right way. So we don't say smoking, we say tobacco addiction. You know, the same way that people don't say alcohol overdose, you know, it is. And you say, oh, alcohol poisoning, right? Which is like a totally fabricated term. You know, it's not really alcohol poisoning, it's alcohol overdose. So when we write, we say tobacco addiction instead of smoking. I think that's really healthy. People are like, oh, ding, I don't have skills for addiction, even though I'm working in addiction.
Any other questions? Let's give another round of applause.